How fortunate we are to have our guests participating tonight, and especially our keynoter. And in just a moment, Captain James Lovell, I'll say a moment about something in just a moment about him. But for now, just so fortunate that he is here with us tonight. Admiral William McRaven is a retired U.S. Navy four-star admiral and former chancellor of the University of Texas System. During his time in the military, he commanded special forces at every level, eventually taking charge of U.S. Special Operations Command. His career included combat during Desert Storm and both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Admiral McRaven is a recognized national authority on U.S. foreign policy and has advised Presidents George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and other U.S. leaders on defense issues. He currently serves on the Council on Foreign Relations and the Defense Innovation Boards. As the Chancellor of the UT system, he led one of the nation's largest and most respected systems of higher education. As Chief Executive Officer of the UT system, Admiral McRaven oversaw 14 institutions that educated 220,000 students and employed 20,000 faculty and more than 80,000 healthcare professionals, researchers, and staff. Admiral McRaven graduated from the University of Texas at Austin in 1977 with a degree in journalism, received his master's degree from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey in 1991. Admiral McRaven and his wife are our very special guests tonight. Admiral McRaven, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Reverend Levinson. You can tell by my voice that I was cheering for my Longhorns yesterday. It was another nail-biter, so I hope you will bear with me. First, let me begin by sending my condolences to the families who lost loved ones in both the tragic shootings in Thousand Oaks, California, and the fires that burned nearby. Our hearts are with you. And to the first responders and the firefighters, know that we veterans consider you our brothers and sisters and are proud to stand by you to protect this nation. Thank you for your service as well. Boy, my mother, God rest her soul, would be so proud of me standing here behind a pulpit addressing a congregation. Now, I think she always assumed I would be part of the sermon, you know, the part about the lost soul or the wayward son or the sinner who needed saving. I was a bit rambunctious as a kid, and I'm sure she wondered if I would ever turn out okay. But before she passed, I know she took great comfort in seeing me in uniform, knowing that I was living a life of service, of duty, honor, and country. That gave her hope that maybe everything would be all right. Well, Mom, everything turned out all right. I think a lot of mothers and fathers are thankful when their sons and daughters join the military, because nothing is more noble, more honorable, or more rewarding than serving your country. And on this Veterans Day, it is a good time to pause and reflect on those that served. And I think it is also a good time to pause and reflect on why they served. In the wars after 9/11, when a young soldier was killed in action, we held what we referred to as a ramp ceremony. The ramp ceremony is both incredibly sorrowful and equally inspiring at the same time. Those attending realize they have lost another great warrior, and that tears at your soul. But the ceremony also honors the fallen, and it represents a nation's gratitude to their service and sacrifice, and that is uplifting. Invariably, the ceremony happens at night. It always seems to be misty and cold in Afghanistan and hot and humid in Iraq. A large C-17 cargo plane arrives from the States and positions itself on the runway with its ramp down, ready to receive the remains of the soldier. Extending off the back of the ramp are two parallel lines of soldiers, men and women from the Fallen Heroes Unit who stand at attention, ready to salute the flag-draped casket as it passes by. Off to the side is a small three-piece band playing Amazing Grace. A military Humvee pulls up with a casket and a six-man honor guard, removes the casket, and slowly marches from the vehicle through the long line of soldiers and onto the aircraft. All along the edge of the runway, hundreds of uniformed and civilian personnel line up to pay their last respects. The pallbearers walk the casket onto the plane and set it down at the front of the cargo bay. They turn, salute the casket, and march smartly off the plane. The officers and the troops from the Fallen Soldiers Unit then board the plane to hear the chaplain's final words. The words are always the same. They never vary, whether said by a priest, a minister, a rabbi, or a layperson. They quote Isaiah 6:8. "Then I heard the voice of the Lord say, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for me?' And I said, 'Here am I, send me.'" Here am I, send me. For 242 years, soldiers have been saying, "Send me. Send me to Lexington and Bunker Hill, to Gettysburg and Antietam. Send me to Manila and San Juan. Send me to Belleau Wood, to the Argonne, to Midway and Normandy, to Chosin and Incheon. Send me away and to Hamburger Hill. Send me to Lebanon, to Panama, to Grenada, to Bosnia, to Kosovo, and to Haiti. Send me to Iraq and Afghanistan, to Syria and Yemen, to Somalia and Niger. Send me wherever the nation needs me. Just send me." But why do they go? And more importantly, why do most of them go so willingly? On October 8, 1918, during World War I, a young Tennessean found himself on the front lines of the Battle of Meuse-Argonne in the forest of France. Prior to the war, the soldier had struggled with the idea of joining the army because of his religious beliefs. He was an ardent Christian pacifist. But on that day, when confronted with the possibility that his battalion would be overrun by the Germans and his men would be killed, the young Tennessean picked up his rifle and attacked the Germans behind their lines. In an unprecedented act of heroism, he saved his men and captured 132 German soldiers. For his actions that day, he would receive the Medal of Honor. When asked how he mustered such courage in the face of overwhelming odds, Sergeant Alvin York said, "A higher power than man guided me and watched over me and told me what to do." Some soldiers fight because they believe there is a higher calling. They believe in the righteousness of their duty and of the divine nature of their actions. I can say without hesitation that I have seen the hand of God in things both big and small. I have witnessed men saved in action when nothing on earth would account for their salvation. And while I would never be so presumptuous to assume that God prefers one good man over another, I do believe that God entrusts in some men and women the mantle of history, a critical part of the grand plan. Some say, "Send me," because they have an abiding faith in the Almighty, and that is a good and powerful reason to serve. For others, the calling begins in childhood, from the first time they put their hand over their heart and say the words, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." And when we raise that same right hand and swear that "I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic," we say, "Send me," because the nation needs us, because we believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that the nation and the principles upon which she was founded are worth fighting for. We believe that all men are created equal. We believe that as a people, we have certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We believe that those qualities set us apart from all other nations, and that those principles are worth defending, worth fighting for, and if necessary, worth dying for. And I would offer, we are right to feel that way. It was the men and women who believed in these principles that put on the uniform and saved the world from Nazism, fascism, communism, and terrorism. Were it not for America, the scourge of tyranny would rule the world today. Those that said, "Send me," understood the power of the American dream, the promise of the American flag, and the certainty of American values. For many, God and country are the two most important reasons to put on the uniform and serve. And good reasons they are. But while no one can deny the importance of God and country as a reason to serve, I believe there is something more basic that sustains the soldiers in battle, something more tangible that brings out the courage, that inspires them to action. That something is you. The people that fill those soldiers' lives with memories and opportunities. When soldiers sit around and talk about what they love, it isn't the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. It isn't the government in Washington or our national policy. It isn't the philosophy of St. Augustine or Martin Luther. When soldiers sit around and talk about what they love, it's their mom's fried chicken and their dad's barbecue. It's Old Man Reuben's pizza pie on a corner in the Bronx. It's catching waves on the pipeline, Friday night football in Midland, and watching hoops at Rucker Park. It's the Kiwanis Club, the Rotary Club, and the Knights of Columbus. It's the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club, the barbershop, and the beauty parlor. It's their wives, their husbands, their kids, their parents, their girlfriends and boyfriends, their teachers, their coaches, and their pastors. And they talk with great pride about their towns and their schools and the things that matter to the people they care about. And sometimes, without even knowing about it, they are talking about you, all of you who give of your time and your resources that allow us, the veterans, to see the art, to hear the music, to watch the dance, to be educated, to be healed. Each and every one of you has affected someone in uniform, whether you know it or not. Somewhere along the way, you have given us our favorite memories, our love of this country. We raise our hand and say, send me, not because of what we hate and fear, but because of what we love and admire. One of my favorite stories from World War II is about the incredible goodwill of the average American. Soon after the war in Europe started, the military began to move soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines from the West Coast to New York City. From New York City, they would board a ship bound for the battlefields of France. The troops from the West Coast would take the Union Pacific Railroad, and along the way, the train would stop at various stations to refuel. One stop along the route was Bailey Yard, located in North Platte, Nebraska. The first time the train stopped was on December 17, 1941. A few of the ladies from the town came out with a sandwich or two for the troops aboard the train. One of those young ladies was 26-year-old Ray Wilson, whose brother was supposed to be on the train, but he had gotten diverted. When she realized the joy the troops got from seeing the townsfolks, she wrote a letter to the North Platte Daily Bulletin. In the letter, she told about meeting the train. I quote, "To see the spirits and the high morale among those soldiers should certainly put some of us on our feet and make us realize we are really at war. We should help keep these soldiers' morale at its highest peak. We can do our part." She went on to say, "An officer told me it was the first time anyone had met their train, that North Platte had helped the boys keep up their spirits. I say, let's do something and do it in a hurry. We can help this way when we can't help any other way." The folks in North Platte heeded the letter from Ray Wilson and came out in droves. Every time the train stopped, more people from the town showed up. They would write cards to the troops, provide food and drinks and magazines. During the longer stops, there would be picnics, dances, and home-cooked meals. Sometimes a hospital train would come through and the ladies with medical training would help out. Every soldier, sailor, airman, and Marine who passed through North Platte felt cared for, felt loved, felt special. From December 1941 until April 1st, 1946, the North Platte Canteen served over 6 million servicemen and women. 6 million. Imagine the impact that one town had on the morale of the troops. And nothing contributes to the strength of the military more than the morale of the troops. So imagine the impact that one town had on the outcome of the war. Of course, many of those troops never returned from Europe. And some of their last memories would be of the kindness of the people of North Platte. You see, the thing is, a military represents the character of the nation, the veterans, the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, and our sons and daughters. They are our sons and daughters, our fathers and mothers, our brothers and sisters, our family and friends. A military is, by extension, everything good and decent about the people they represent. The future of this nation, the strength of the military, will always depend on the character of the people of this country. So on this Veterans Day, I want to thank each and every one of you for being the kind of people worth sacrificing for, worth fighting for. Worth dying for. worth dying for and worth saying, send me. Thank you very much.